University of Illinois, Department of Anthropology, talking this evening to Mrs. Irma Bridgewater of 608 East Washington, Champaign, Illinois. Mrs. Bridgewater was one of the founders of the Douglas Community Center, has been very active and instrumental in the development of opportunities for blacks in the Champaign-Urbana community. And this evening, we'll explore in a preliminary fashion her involvement in the Douglas Community Center and hopefully learn a bit about her fascinating and wonderful life. With that brief introduction, I'd like to begin by asking Mrs. Bridgewater if she could tell us a bit perhaps about her early childhood in Champaign, what it was like being black growing up in a city like Champaign-Urbana, whether there were things that happened here that she might think were a little out of the ordinary, or things that stand out in her memory that particularly impressed her during her childhood, and perhaps just reminisce a bit about some of her old childhood friends and her school days, and perhaps give us a humorous story or two. With that, I'll turn it over to Mrs. Bridgewater.
Well, I was born in the north part of Champaign. My mother and dad were living with his mother. And we lived there after I was born. Of course, we lived there until, for I think about a year, I'm not sure about that. Then they found the house in the south part of Champaign. And that was clear out on Ells Avenue. That was considered, you know, clear out in the country at that time. It was an older home, and they managed to start buying it. I think it was about $1,500, which sounds fantastic now. I had another brother, too. There were just the two of us. The area was primarily white. There was another black family up in the next block from us. And my playmates were white. And it didn't, I don't know, it was all right. It didn't bother me at that time. When we started the school, there was just my brother and I, and that's, I guess, when I began to realize that there were some differences. My parents had always told me, if you're nice to people, they'll be nice to you. And, which sounds real good, but then when you get into playing games on the playground, and you reach to take somebody's hand, and they don't want to take your hand, and you're left out of games, and the teacher is nice enough to come to you and take your hand and get you into the game. And as I remember, the youngsters who did pay more attention to us were the ones who seemed to have more money. The poor ones, there were a lot of poor white people around there then. They just, I don't know, guess they thought they were a little better. The nicer things that happened to me then, though, were in music. The teacher we had, her name was Miss Rose. I think a good many black people liked her, not only in that school, but in other schools. And she would let me sing either soprano or alto, and I felt great about that because I could do either one. There were programs where, school programs, naturally, where I had a chance to shine a bit. I remember one of the most disappointing things that happened to me was that we took classical, had classical music where they played the records and you listened to them and you had to name the tune or the and where the suite it was from and everything about it, and you just heard a little bit of it. And that contest went clear on up to the state. I got clear up to the point where I was to go to the state. I had passed everything. And when I think about it now, it really upsets me. But I had written, had everything perfect, except when my paper came back, they said I had an extra hump on an M. And that was what kept me from going to the state. Of course, I took it home, and parents tried to make me feel good about it, but it was completely unfair. But that's the way things were then. I went on, of course, and finished grade school at Lincoln School. There were only, my brother and I and one or two other people, two boys that were in the area. Some of the teachers were very good. I remember I had an accident where I got burned, and I was out of school for over a month and had to learn to walk again, really. I think I was in third grade. When I went back to school, one of the teachers asked me if I'd like to be in her room, and of course that was the one I wanted. So I was happy about that, and I did get back into her room. That was sort of disastrous in a way, because my mother had sent me out to burn some papers. My brother had chicken pox, and he was looking out the window, and I held up one of the pieces of rag or paper or something that was burning. When I put it down on the ground, and I stooped over and caught my dress afire. And I knew, I'd been told in school, you know how they tell you, don't run. And that's what I did. I took off running. There was an open field right next to us. And I started running, and my brother told my mother, and she came out and knocked me down and put it out with her hands. I had a scar on my side, and then I got chicken pox in the burn, so I was in bad shape there for a while. But I survived. Another thing that I remember about grade school was a play that we had, and they had it at the high school, and I sang a song by myself with my little colored doll. It was colored doll, and my parents came, and of course they sat upstairs. And I felt real good about that. That was one of the nicer things that happened to me in grade school. When we went on to high school, another thing I remember, not long ago, well, a couple of years ago, somebody asked me to take part in a discussion, and one of the things they wanted to know was about racism. What was racism? So my answer was to give them some examples of racism that I had gone through, and one I'll never forget was when I was coming home from school, and there were some men down in a ditch, digging a ditch, and one of them said to the other, "Well, it looks like it's going to rain. There's a black cloud going over." I went home, of course, told my parents about it, and they said, "Well, you just ignore that. Consider the source." But, you know, as kids coming up, we took an awful lot of that junk. And I don't remember whether this was when I was in grade school or, I guess it was grade school. We had a riot. You know, one thing brings on another. I'll probably ramble on quite a bit.
That's what we want you to do. Let it all flow, you know.
The Ku Klux were pretty active. I don't remember years, you know, especially, but I do remember there was a woman that was buying a house two blocks up the street from us, and about time for her to move in, the Ku Klux decided that they burned a cross in front of her house. And we had some white friends that were nice enough to let us know what was going on, and they were supposed to do something or other that night. I don't know what it was, but I remember my dad had us to go hide, and some of the men got clubs and so forth and went on up on the tracks to watch. Nothing happened, but you know, you always think that all that happened in the South, but it happened up here, right in Champaign, just like it did every place else. High school was, it had its problems too. I remember we wanted to take swimming, and we weren't allowed to take swimming with the rest of the classes, at all, matter of fact. And my parents and two or three others decided that they wanted us to take swimming. Now, that was back in the 20s. And sometimes we look at things now and think that people didn't do the things that they did do in order to get into different areas where we weren't supposed to be, so they said. But they went to the school and demanded that we be allowed to swim. Well, it ended up that we were swimming after school, after everybody else was through. But it was a beginning, and it was something they felt proud of because they fought for it. And I guess my parents were determined that I would go to college. So when they came along with these ideas that you shouldn't take English, or you shouldn't take this, that, and the other, algebra or geometry, because you probably won't pass it, they made me take it. Of course, I didn't have any problem with them making me take it, because I knew I was going to, and it never did occur to me not to go to college. That was just a part of growing up. That was what I was expected to do. And so when they told me not to take it, or I shouldn't take those courses, my parents insisted that I had to take them, and I took them. I wasn't a great student. I was an average student, but anyhow, I passed them. There were other things that we didn't do that I'm sorry we didn't, or I didn't get to, and that was in high school. I didn't get into the choruses or into any of the music I would like to have. Probably, had I tried, I might have done it. But you get to the point where you don't see any blacks, and you just suppose that that's just not for you. So you go on and do the next best thing. I was one of these. I was backward. I was a scared student because I didn't. I was afraid to hold up my hand, and even if I knew the answer. You know, I figured that they knew it, so they answer it. And that probably didn't help my grades any. But that was just my backward way at that time. I didn't want to be that way, and I fought hard against it. After I got into college, I began to realize that I could change if I wanted to. And I did want to, so. But then I had some of the same kind of experiences at the university. I was in a class in English literature, and the instructor in seating the class did it alphabetically, and there were two of us in there. The other girl's name was Barbie and mine was Scott. So when it got to She got to the B's, she didn't call Barbie. So she got to the S's, she didn't call Scott. And after she had seated everybody, you know, you were standing up around the wall, and then as you were called, you sat down. And there, the two of us left standing there, and then she put us together. So I told my dad about it. He was working at the university at the time. He told Mr. Lee, who was working in the president's office. Mr. Lee told the president. President called the head of the college and called her in to talk to her about it, to the teacher. And when she finally called us in, she said that she thought we wanted to sit together. Well, it wasn't necessary. We did know each other, but we didn't have to sit together. But that was her answer for that. She thought we wanted to sit together. And then she started telling a tale that I have never been able to understand. Something about she's always worried about being an angel because she couldn't play a harp. Now, I never did figure out what that had to do with depriving us of or embarrassing us by letting us stand there. And I never did understand it. I worked hard enough to get a C out of the course. The other girl, I think, got a D. But it's that thing of having to forgive people for things like that and still sit in the class and get a decent grade out of them. That's rough. I finished in 37. And I think the happiest person was my dad, because he was still working over there. And to have his daughter graduate was really something with him. And it had been a struggle, too, for him, because he played policy sometime to get enough money to to pay my tuition. And at that time, tuition was $35, and we thought it was terrible when it went up to $50. What is it now?
Well, it's about $3,000 a year.
Yeah, it was, it really, 35 was a whole lot of money then. I worked some on Saturdays and helped as much as I could. My mother did a few washings, so on. But when I finished, my first job was maid at the university at Newman Hall. And it was under a black woman who was as mean as I don't know what. My mother was working there too at the time, but I had looked around trying to find a job and couldn't, or at least I wasn't able to right away. But I worked there until I decided it was time to leave and try something else. I've never wanted to leave Champaign. I always felt that I could find something here, some way, somehow. And I did travel, go around a little bit with some people who lived down the street from us to looking for work in social work. Of course, my degree was in sociology. At that time, there wasn't a school of social work. And I just didn't find anything. Until the Douglas Center, or wasn't really Douglas Center, it was Neighborhood House in the beginning, and it was under WPA, and that was when they changed it over, the city took over the Douglas. Took over the program was when I was hired as recreation leader. But that was, they had a full staff there then. It was on WPA, and I was the only person there with a college degree, and they sure made it tough for me for a while. They, you know how we do. It's you think who you think you are, and I lived on the other side of town, and they sent me home crying quite a bit in the beginning, because for one thing, that the woman that was director I had no training in recreation. And as director, she didn't help me much. She sent me down to the swings to swing the kids, and which wasn't too bad because I was learning to get used to youngsters. But then I went, I finally went to the office and told them I wasn't learning anything. They got after, and then she started teaching me crafts and so on. But the rest of the staff was just as bad in that respect. So I finally decided that what I had to do was to say a few curse words here and there and to do a few things, you know, and say that I drank a little bit now and then, just in order to get in with them. It worked. It took a little time, but it worked. And we finally got to where we got along swell together. But being the only employee from the city, on the city's payroll, made it a little difficult. In time, the director left, and I continued to work there. Now, at that time, Douglas Center was a house in Douglas Park, and it was a six-room house. That's where I learned to make a fire in a furnace, because it had a furnace in the basement. There was a pretty good program there. We had a good outdoor program, baseball, softball.
You were telling me about how you learned to make fire.
Yes, make fire in a furnace. Well, as I said, the program there was a good one. It involved, especially the part in the park. We had a lot of elderly people there who played shuffleboard, checkers, and I'm not sure of my years, but the Chanute Field had, there were a lot of soldiers from there who came down, and we had special programs for them, although there was that jealousy between the townspeople, you know, the youngsters, especially about the girls and the soldiers. It was the 99th squadron that was up there at that time. There were a good many of them were college graduates, and I think pilots. There was quite a few of them were pilots at that time too. There were dances out in the park, some tennis, not much, but the program was pretty good. I was sent to a conference in Dayton, Ohio, and that's when I got excited about a new center, because I was there representing, I was sitting in a, I think it was about $200,000 building in Dayton with all kinds of facilities and everything, and representing a house, a six-room house with 13 broken windows. and then from there we went to visit a center in Lima, Ohio, and there were about, they had an $80,000 building, and I think there were about 500 blacks in there, and they even had a swimming pool. And I figured, well, if they can do that, then we ought to be able to do something. And I came back all inspired and talking, and my dad and Richard Edwards, Mr. Foxwell, a few of them formed a committee, Ray Hines, and began talking about a center. Also the community chest, which later became United Way, had some extra funds. Along with that, though, there was also this idea of not having a USO, or not wanting black soldiers to come into the USO that they had here. And so then, in that case, then they needed some place for them to go. We had left the house because a man wanted it back and had gone to the American Legion Hall. They let us in there for a while. Then we went to a church basement, to the CME church basement, and from there on to Lawhead School basement. So we were sort of going around, and that was where the Lawhead Servicemen Center was, in the Lawhead School basement. That turned out to be real nice. We had some nice programs there. One of the young men I saw in New York once who was active in the one of our Christmas programs we had, also in some of the programs we had there at the center. And then from that, we were able, from the community chest, they had some surplus funds. And with that and the fact that there were some people who said, if you raise a certain amount, we'll give a certain amount. And I think it was on...
Was that the war chest?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They started that campaign for money on the date, December 7th. What was it? They bombed Japan, Hiroshima. It was December 7th, 1941. And which made it a good time to start raising money, too. Then the center was built in 45. And I was there as director for 1 month. And my husband came back from the Navy, and I decided I was ready to go home. By that time, I had had first child, because that was when I was still working. That was before the Lawhead Servicemen Center. I was working in Lawhead School with the preschool program. I remember I was pregnant. One of the boys said, "Miss Bridgewater, Miss Scott, you sure are getting fat." And then I left, quit. Because I got married in 41. He was born late in 42. And then when my husband went to the Navy, I went back to work, went back to Douglas, and worked until he came home. Then I quit from 45 to 55, I think it was. I believe. Because there was a 10-year span there when I didn't work, and I was decided to quit and raise my children. I didn't work there, but I did. My dad and I served parties during that time.
You mean catering?
Catering, yeah. He was very good at that. And it was something I could do and still work, stay at home. And I enjoyed working with him, too. And the money was pretty good, came in handy. Then I went back to work after the kids were all up. I hadn't really planned to, but we wanted to do some work on the house, and they asked me to come back, so I went back. And it took me, having been away about 10 years from young people, It took me about a month to get used to their slang and their dances and everything else. And I sat around for that month and watched them. Finally, I learned that some of the dances, and you know, if you can do that, you're in. So I was in with them then. And I stayed there for about 9 years. We had some good programs. I really enjoyed working with the youngsters. Of course, I had the girls. I went there as assistant director then. And we had drill teams. I taught sewing, cooking. I even learned to square dance so I could teach it. I think one of the greatest advantages to me in I was able to have my children come there after school. And I got to know what other kids were wearing, what they were doing, the slang, that I even taught mine some of the dances. And I think it not only helped me, but it helped them a lot too. It helped them to get used to other kids and to fit in. And they never had problems with getting along with the rest of them because they were just, you know, in with them. They went to Washington School. My youngest child was my daughter. She went to Washington School, and of course she could come right there after school. The rest of them could come there. They got into basketball and track. In fact, there was a time when I thought I didn't care much about track. It seemed to, you know, just sitting around waiting for somebody's turn to get ready to run. But when I found out my youngest son could run track, boy, I really got into it then. And then we got some girls into track, and I really got involved in it. And we took them, oh, as far as state meets in the J.C. Jamboree. And we had a lot of winners, too. That was one of the, really the most rewarding things I think that had happened to me was in the work at Douglas Center. And as I see the kids, well, see them now as young men and women, they still are anxious to come up and let me know what the good things they're doing. And that's really gives you a real lift. And I stayed there then until 64, I believe it was, as director part of that time. And they decided they needed a man as director, which was fine. I didn't have any quarrel with that. But then when they finally got him, they cut my salary in order to pay his. And I felt like that was asking a little bit too much. And so I left. And I got a job then. Let's see, I was 50 years old then, which is kind of old to go out looking for a job. So I went to the university, and I either had too much education for some of their jobs and not nearly enough for others. So I ended up at the Courier newspaper as old fiddlesticks. Well, anyhow, proofreader. And that turned out to be a pretty good job because I was it. You know, that was when they had to have one. And I was it. Spooked to sat by the door. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. The people who were working with me were, beside me, were high school graduates, and that part used to bug me to think that had I been a high school graduate, I probably couldn't have gotten the job. But I stayed there until the Urban Renewal Program came into being. And Mr. James L. Williams asked me if I'd like to apply for it as for a relocation officer or assistant to him. So I did, and I enjoyed that too because I had a chance to, having lived here all my life, I knew a lot of the people, and I had to sort of psych myself up with the job because it was a job where you go and tell people that they got to move and they got to get out of their houses. But I finally decided that what we were really doing was helping them to live better, to live in better homes, and that was really what was happening. And I stayed there for 3 years until the program was closed and did a darn good job, to be honest. According to HUD, they wrote letters complimenting us on the fact that we had not only completed the job on time, but had done a good job in our relocation program. That, when that program was over, we were expected to have been given jobs in the city. You know, we were separate from the city's program because we even had our offices across the street. But they found a place for everybody, but they didn't find one for me, so I was out again. I then went to Francis Nelson Health Center to some more work that I enjoyed as a community worker. I stayed there 4 years. And then they called me back. I had said I would never go back to be a city employee again. But Mr. Williams came along and waved a green flag in front of my nose. It was more than I had received when I was working there before. So I went back. And I'm still there, but they're about to do it to me again. They've changed, put us under planning. And this new director is, not the director, well, the planning director. Because we had our own director, but has resigned. And she has decided that she would not have any acquisition and relocation for the next year. So I think I will resign too. She had offered me a part-time job. But a part-time job is also a temporary job. Mm-hmm. And it's about, if I stayed another year, I could retire. Mm-hmm. However, if I buy back some of the time that I had before, I can still leave with a pension, which is what I think I'll do. But I don't think I'm through working yet. I'm going to find something else to do. And I've gone from start to finish there.
Yeah, that's a fascinating account. Far more than I had really anticipated, to be quite honest. But tell me, do you consider yourself unusual? I have been in and around Champaign for years, and I think you're one of the few people from this, blacks from this community I've met who has actually received, I think I've met one or two others, who received degrees from the university here.
Who are still living here.
Who are still living here, yes, that's correct.
We, and I'm guilty of that too, we have sort of played down our degrees, and that sounds terrible probably, because there are other people here who have them. There's Bernice Brightwell, who worked, who's been here all her life, too. Taylor Thomas, I'm sure you've heard of him. And he was born here. His wife was born here. She has a degree from University of Illinois. Well, there are many others who have attended. But I don't know why. I guess because we all more or less feel like we're, no matter what you have, we're still just people around here.
Mm-hmm. How does obviously another community of people who are not from here, who have received degrees from the university, tend, by and large, not to live in what would be characterized as the older Black community here. Is there any tension that stems from that? Or?
No, just that idea, I think, that we play it down. I don't know whether I should say play it down, but there are a lot of people who don't know that I have a degree, and I'm people that I'm close with and around. I don't know. It doesn't bother me. For one thing, my husband doesn't have one. And I have never, I guess that's another reason that I haven't even been too active with the sorority, with the graduate chapter of the sorority. Because I never want to do anything that makes him feel uncomfortable. But I'm proud of the fact that I went. And it was a struggle. It's only when I get to talking about it that I realize that it was a struggle. And at that time, too, you were given what they call colored C's. And I've told my daughter since then, I probably got some better grades, deserve some better grades than I got.
So colored C would be equivalent to what?
White B or A.
Now, in general, I've heard people say that some people here kind of resent the fact that in the old days, when there was housing segregation at the university, for example, that people here profited from that, in a sense, and that students would rent rooms, and there was a certain amount of the inflow of capital that came through the university that got siphoned off into the Black community. And then with full-scale integration, that dried up. And some people were unhappy about that. What are your feelings on that?
Well, I was unhappy about it because there became a complete separation. You know, when I was coming up, we knew students from the university as people in the community, you know, that we were all together. They all attended the same church as we did. They were a help to us. We had, our church had a Baraka class that was made up of mostly students from the university, and the Lyceum was made up of students. Our choir had a lot of students from the university, so that they were fully a part of the university, and that's one reason I have enjoyed the Culture Center, because they have sort of brought us back together again in some ways, if it's no more than the Black Chorus. You know, the Black Chorus really did use some of the people from in the community. And then they have invited us into a lot of activities over there. And when the students began to live on campus, it just separated us.
Do you think that there are other things that could be done that would
bring us back together?
Sure.
I think the churches could be a little more active in it. Of course, I realize that one of the problems is that Black churches hold up longer. And maybe meal times are expected. You're expected to be there back at a certain time for meals. But the churches could take care of that by serving meals at times. We've talked about it at Bethel, but we haven't done anything about it. I don't know. our programs seem to be those that take us to the university, which is good, because a lot of people probably would never go out there if it wasn't for some of the programs that they have had out there. But we don't have programs in the community that bring the students to us. Uh-huh. And I don't know.
Two-way flow.
Yeah. Because, there have been some awfully good programs that have taken us to the Krannert and so on, and free, too, mm-hmm. so that we couldn't have that for an excuse.
Have there been any efforts made to sort of woo black students to come and live in this part of town?
I think there's so much feeling. No, I don't think there have been any efforts. It's easier. It was easier to stay in a dorm because somebody was cleaning your room. You know, you were getting all those services. It was something they hadn't been used to, and I can understand that. It's like I enjoy going someplace and going to a motel where I couldn't before. I don't have to worry about anything. Where I may have had to go and visit my relatives, I can go see them and go back to the hotel now.
So you think it's the convenience that...
I think so.
What about in the area of... what are the major, if you could pick out, let's say, 3 or 4 changes in the area of employment that have been striking during your lifetime for blacks in this community, what would you say they were?
One of them would be... working on campus, cooking and waiting table and that sort of thing. My grandmother on my mother's side was a cook on campus. In fact, that's what brought them to Champaign, because she was a widow with 2 girls, and she came here and got a job on campus cooking. That's one of the major changes I've seen. I don't know who does the cooking on campus now, but there certainly aren't as many that I know of. The fraternities and sororities had their own served meals. Now, I don't know whether they still do or not. Maybe they,
yes,
do.
They do.
Do they?
Mm-hmm.
And the students got their meals from waiting table. And the men, sometimes couples worked and lived on campus. I don't know what some of the other jobs might be that have changed. A lot of women worked in service, cleaning house and so forth. Now they have cleaning agencies that come in and do that sort of thing. Some of them do. There were some of the more wealthy families on the west side of town that had people who worked for them, sometimes husbands and wives there too. But as they became a little more skilled in different jobs, we've had more people working on campus in other kinds of jobs, some in foods too. But I was surprised in a study that I read the other day of the area up here from Crystal Lake over to Prospect. $30 million a year in this area, in that area, and that seemed fantastic to me. A whole lot of them are homeowners.
$30 million in what, disposable income? Or
it didn't say exactly.
Or is that gross?
Gross, yeah.
So that much comes into the community?
That much is made here in the community.
Annually?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can do quite a bit with that.
Yes, you can. That study was made in order to back up the idea of having a shopping center up this way.
Mm-hmm.
But with that much money, I'm sure the White Fathers are going to make sure that it keeps going where it's been going.
What about places like craft and other employment opportunities beyond the university? Are those relatively new developments? And if so, what did people do who weren't associated with the university in the old days? Say before craft was located here. Are there types of alternative employment alternatives?
Oh, what did they do? Of course, I know what mine did. My dad did. But there were friends of her theirs who, like I say, worked in the more wealthy families as chauffeurs and heck, I don't know. I can't. It was primarily labor. There were men, of course, who worked on railroads. Red caps. I know my brother worked on the IC railroad for a while.
Do you remember?
It's all labor.
Do you remember whether there was much unemployment in your recollections of, say, the employment picture for blacks in this town?
I didn't, I guess I didn't feel it. My dad had a steady job. And, of course, during the Depression, that was pretty rough. But they had the kind of jobs that, see, this isn't a factory town. It isn't like, something closes down and you're out of work. It was the kind of work they were doing was steady work. Because Mr. Charlie still had to have his breakfast. Huh. And they, of course, worked out just like they do now. Because my dad worked at university and then still worked at Urbana, at Champaign Country Club. That hired quite a few as waiters. And there were other places, too, where they used black waiters. That was considered the thing then.
Were there any opportunities for blacks to learn skills? And to become electricians or masons? Or?
No. Not even masons. They usually came from the South.
With their skills?
Yeah, with their skills. Although my grandpa was a hod carrier. But you see, they did the labor part of it, the heavier part, but I don't. There wasn't too much of an opportunity to learn skills other than that.
Were blacks unionized?
No. Mm-mm. We were talking the other day about the fact that there weren't too many that got pensions. I guess we're just getting into that. Because they didn't work on jobs where they could get a pension.
What did they do when they retired?
You just kept on working until you fell out. Or go live with some, relatives or somebody to take care of. They hard worked until they got sick enough to, that was it.
Did that affect families any? Did that make them closer? Did it strain the relations within families or what?
I think families were a lot closer then than they are now. I think families are becoming closer, but because we've always taken in each other, because I remember my uncle got sick. He left Chicago and came down here and he stayed with us until he died. My grandmother, grandfather lived with us in our, you know, with my mother and dad. And we just took care of each other. You're hard up, you go home. Of course, we weren't elderly, didn't go into housing, old folks' home or that sort of thing. They stayed right with the family.
Well, actually, you know, I've got a long list of things I'd like to talk with you about.
Oh?
But, I don't want to tire you out too much in one session.
Well, I'll agree with you on that.
I think it might be better to perhaps break at this point.
Okay,
and
fine.
And then, say, resume another day.
All right, when I've had time to think of a few more things.
Oh, I'm sure you wouldn't have a problem, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, the physical fatigue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's been nice thinking about things.
Yeah, it's been very informative. It's certainly a pleasure for me to listen to you and to share your thoughts. Hopefully this will become part of a series of documents which would be available to the general community, and perhaps everyone mm-hmm. could share your experiences and benefits.
Would there be some way of tying them in together so that is that part of the thinking? It would be a big job, I admit.
Yes, it would require a lot of editing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, sure, that's quite possible. That would be a simple matter, during time-consuming, but
yeah.
I mean, conceptually it's not very difficult, but it's just a lot of physical labor.
Yeah, listening.
Logging in a lot of hours to do it, but
uh-huh.
you could look for patterns. And then write something that would look like a social history of the
community. Mm-hmm.
And then use the case histories, or life histories, to flesh it out, illustrate points that were
mm-hmm.
salient. Yeah, I think it would make a very nice book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. I know a lot of students have done studies in this area, and I've often wondered what happened to them. Because sometimes they'll come back, you know, somebody else will come back for some of the same material.
Mm.
And I've always been, it was always white students there for a long time. And I've been so glad that we've had black students to start coming into the area and asking questions and so on. Especially from urban planning, we've met them at work. And I enjoy working with them.
Well,
okay.
Thank you very much for
mm-hmm.
your time this evening.
Working for Douglas Branch Library on the Life History Project. And this evening we're interviewing for the second time Mrs. Irma Bridgewater. And taking advantage of her vast storehouse of wisdom and knowledge about the Champaign-Urbana community. During our last session, we asked Mrs. Bridgewater to provide us with a general background of the community and her life in it, her impressions of it. This evening, I'd like to start by asking her to perhaps give us a brief history or characterization, I should say, of the directors of the Douglas Center, who these people were, and perhaps something about what their major accomplishments and faults were, and, if possible, perhaps give us some insights into their personalities and characters. This is good.
I see. The first director that I can was associated with was Mrs. Odelia Wesley, and that was when the center was in the park, in Douglas Park. She was a very knowledgeable person. She had been a school teacher in her hometown, and was very good with crafts. In fact, that she was working under WPA. That was what, in the 30s, I guess. Yeah, I know it was. And that was before the center or the city took over the recreation program. There was a very good program, well-rounded program there at that time. Rochelle Broom was director of men and boys activities, and he was good for inside. He was great with checkers. He was a good disciplinarian for the youngsters, and he was, because he was fond of them. He was good, awfully good with softball. He had good softball leagues in the park. He was always an umpire. And people came out primarily, well, as much to hear him as anything else. He had a good sense of humor, too. A very good rapport with the kids, youngsters. When I started, it was when there with Mrs. Wesley as director. They began then, that was the year that they took over. City took over the program, and I became her assistant. She stayed for a while and got a job at Chinook Field teaching. And when we left there, we went on to the church, as I said before, and I was. I guess I was director then. Then on to the Longhead Servicemen Center. And we had a director there from Danville, Mrs. Buford, that was the center we had instead of the USO, where the black soldiers came. It was the Longhead School. That was a good program. She was a very good director. We were working with adults completely then. They had to raise the salary of the overall director of the recreation. At that time, the person that was over us, because she demanded the salary, which was, you know, great, but it was more than what they were getting, so in order to get it, they had to raise the other salaries. She didn't stay too long, and when she left, that took her place, and that didn't last long either, because in the meantime, we were building Douglas Center. The first of the center, and I went over there as director for, I think, about a month. My husband came back from the Navy, and I was ready to take off with the rest of my family. Taylor Thomas then was, I believe, the next director. I guess most everybody remembers Taylor. He had finished Tennessee, and
Tennessee
A&M. A&M, yeah. And he had, I don't know whether he finished in, he was a good athlete, because he had been a good athlete in high school, too. So he was able to take over that part of it very easily. I don't remember who else worked with him, because for the next 10 years, I was at home. And I don't know who else worked with him. I know he had there was a tragedy there at the time, the outside one, the fellow got shot and killed.
What was the reason?
I don't remember. I think it was a fight outside sometime. Mm-hmm. But there were always fights. After that, now I can't tell you the progression of directors because, like I say, I wasn't around at the time. So, but I remember one of the very best, I think the best that the center, one of the best the center has had was, well, that'll help a lot, won't it? Can't think of his name. From Springfield. He was here in school. He finished in recreation. And his instructor was Al Sapora. He was able to, I'll think of this one. He was able to bring students from the university because they could get credit for it because he had a degree in stuff. He had some well-structured programs. Of course, I still wasn't involved, but I did hear about him, and I know that he did get out into the community and try to organize some programs. He really went at it the way it should have been. He, of course, being that good, didn't stay too long, and I don't remember exactly how long he stayed, but after him, there have been a few who had degrees. I remember one of them, I still don't remember his name. I'm not going to be a good name now. He was a great disciplinarian, and so much so that I think he lost out. You know, he stuck too much to the regulations. The next one that I finally worked with was Hersey. He became the director and was there when I went back to work there in 55. We worked together then until the time I left, or almost until the time I left, because he left before I did. But he was good with sports. We had some good programs there, and I can talk more about that because I was working with it. Basketball, especially for the youngsters, we had grade school basketball, and our kids usually won. And they claimed that it was because we had access to the gym, which sounded logical. So in order to help the rest of them along, we invited them to bring their teams. One school did bring their team out to practice. And the kids sure enjoyed playing against them, too. So we found out the crowd, you know, the kids that were watching, mm-hmm. were making too much of a difference between the two, you know, blacks and whites. Mm-hmm. So he finally went ahead and mixed them up mm-hmm. into, divided them up into teams with their practice. And that turned out real well. He insisted that the boys square dance. Lee Carey was the name of that other guy.
There were two. Which one?
Well, he was
one from Tennessee A&M. And
no, well, that was. Oh, now you got me going again. No, the one that was graduated from the University of Illinois.
And recreation.
Yeah, Lee Carey.
That's Lee Carey.
Yeah. Okay, that's as far back as I'm going with that. But Percy also, well, as I was saying, we had square dancing in the schools, you know. So we had to have our group of square dancers. And he made the boys learn to square dance before, along with them playing basketball. Oh, they hated it. But they got to be pretty good. And he and I both had to learn square dance because, you know, square dance isn't one of our things. Mm-hmm. But we both learned square dance and taught the girls and the boys. They had an all-city square dance at the high school. And they were able to participate. Of course, our kids danced among themselves. Then, of course, we had outdoor programs, too, with the softball leagues. We got into track, too. That was the Jamboree, J.C. Jamboree. They started with children of three different ages, sets of ages. And we entered our kids into it. I got interested in track. And like I said before, I had never really paid much attention to track, but when my son got in it and we went to took the team to Chicago and he won, well, from then on I was a track enthusiast. And we organized a girls' track team along with the boys. And we went to all the way to the state. Some of them have had state records that they kept. And I was really proud of those youngsters. We had girls' clubs that gave a special kind of dance during the year. We taught cooking. I taught cooking back in that dirty kitchen. We'd have to clean it up because the boys go back there and change their clothes and mess it up. But we did have a stove back there. And we made cookies and so on after school. And we had, the programs were set so that the younger children were there right after school, then junior high school, and then adults. The programs were very well attended. We finally got to where we had skating on once a week, and we had people coming from Danville and as far as Springfield for our skating program. And we had dances too. But that was a very exciting time in my life, I believe. And I was able to bring my kids there. They came there to school, stayed until I came home for dinner, and then of course the dad was with them after that. And I think that was really something for them because they got to, they got to play with other kids. I got to see how they played. To me it's important to not only be around your children, but see who they play with, what they say, what their interests are, and it's great when you can take part with them. After I left when I left, it was they had hired a man whose name was Williams. They had hired him from someplace in Ohio, I think, from Ohio. He brought his whole family here. He didn't stay very long. The kids responded best to somebody they knew. And they didn't know him, or he hadn't been around, and didn't seem to be able to get in with them. They missed Hersey, because he left. And they didn't respond to him very well. I know I was kind of disappointed too, because when he came, when they said they were hiring a man, I said, fine, that's all right, as long as he's going to take over responsibilities, but he didn't quite get them all. Some of them were left on me too. So he didn't stay very long. I think after that, they got a local person. McKnight was his name. He worked out very well because they liked him too. It wasn't too long after that then that they started working on the new center. And I don't know what, I don't remember now what year that was. I'm not sure that McKnight was the last one. Seemed to me there was somebody after that. But of course on the new place, with the new center, Nate Dixon, of course, is the present director. He had been in the program a long time, too. He had been with us before. He played basketball. So that he worked in, he'd been in very well. Some of the old assistants, one of them was worked along with me as assistant director in boys' activity. I'll think of that in a minute too. But, and I, when I left, I wanted them to keep him on, but they wouldn't do it. Could have done it, I think. But I think actually there have been some good directors of the programs up there, and they've all done well, I think. I don't think they've had any bad ones.
What do you see as the difference that this center has made in the life of the community? Let's say if you looked at the community before the center was established and since it's been around, do you see any, say, three or four major changes that have been brought about by the presence of this center here in the community?
One of the things that we thought would happen didn't happen, and that is that it would become a meeting place. Mm-hmm. Now that when the first Douglas Center was built, one of the Masonic Lodge met there, but the acoustics weren't very good in the building. It has helped to bring people together, youngsters, but it hasn't done what I would like to have seen it do for adults. Now there's more of it being done now with the senior citizens, since they have a quiet spot there with the annex. But of course it depends on what you call adults. Young men in the program never did seem to really grow out of it. You know, they just grew up in it, and they stayed there, and they stayed there with it with the adult basketball teams and so on. So in that way, but then the older adults really haven't been as active in it as I had thought they might be.
Is that because of the lack of structured programs? How would you account for that?
Well, there haven't been any quiet places for them. Now, in the beginning, or earlier, there were shuffleboard courts, and some of the older people came up for that. Or they have come to watch the ball game. But they haven't done too much in the way of participating. But it's been a wonderful place for youngsters. And we've had some awful large crowds around there without too much difficulty. There have been some day camp programs recently. We've never had enough people working there. That's been one of the big problems every director's had. You have to concentrate on either one or two activities. You couldn't have other activities around. I don't know how Nate is doing with that now, but that has always been one of the problems.
What's the big constraint of funding?
Yeah.
How is the center funded now, and what has been the history of funding since the founding of the center?
It's been through taxes, you know, the proportion of taxes. One of our problems has been that people have complained about the amount of money that is spent at Douglas Center in comparison to other centers. You know, at times there were only two or three centers, or, well, I guess there probably aren't too many more than that now. But our programs demanded, you know, more money, but then we didn't always get it, and we were always short of equipment that we needed. So we ended up giving dancers or something to buy our own equipment. And now I think they've gotten around to where they have paid programs. Mm. You know, but that was never heard of before. And of course, we leaders have been known to buy the equipment and stuff to work with in Northern. Have a showing and they have a program. But we did give things in order to get money to buy the supplies that we needed. Mm-hmm.
So the community has not only contributed through taxes, but also from time to time raised additional funds.
Yeah. And when you say taxes, it reminds me of the open house they had for the Douglas Annex. And we had all these elderly people sitting around there who had been paying taxes for years. And this lady from the park board gets up and talks about what we have done for you. And it was as much as I could take. I ended up writing a letter to the editor, because the people she was talking to were people who had been paying taxes for years. And they were entitled to it. And it wasn't that somebody came along and gave it to them. Mm-hmm. It came out of their tax money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's often people phrase things in such a way that it makes, mm-hmm. they make it sound as if it's
oh, look at the wonderful things we've done for you.
Yeah, that's a good point. You mentioned something last time about housing and the changes that have taken place in housing patterns, especially racially, from your early years up to the present, and the changes in patterns. I was wondering if you could give us a bit of an idea of what happened once certain laws changed in terms of the impact or influence that legislation has had on housing segregation or integration here in Champaign.
When I started with the urban renewal program, you know, we started acquiring properties. Of course, then we had to relocate before we find a place for them to go. About the same time, the fair housing amendment came in. And we noticed, one of the things I noticed first was that when we go to realtors to look for houses for people, we find that restricted, you know, in their books and so on. But of course that gradually changed. And at that time, people were wanting to move when their property was purchased. They wanted to be relocated out in the community, you know, because they had, I mean, out in other areas of the community, because they hadn't been able to live in those other areas. And that was what happened. But what really happened was little pockets were set up in various places. You know, one person moves here, and then pretty soon the house next door becomes for sale, and little areas were built up around in the city. As time has gone on, people have moved out to various areas of the city. I've noticed that with community development, now that was back in 67, with community development in 75 on, we haven't had as many people moving that far out of this community. They've wanted to stay around in the area. My feeling is that the feeling they have is now I have a choice. I can stay here if I want to. You know, I don't have to move way out there. Then, too, taxes are higher out in those other areas, too. And that's another reason, of course, they would stay up this route. When I was younger, we lived out on Els, and there were just a few blacks there, and that was quite a few years ago. And when we moved here, there were, we moved here in the 40s, and this area had, this house was owned by whites, and then there were some left in the neighborhood, but gradually, we've gone clear down to university and from university on up north. Mm-hmm. So it's become, and there were quite a few white families up around even farther north, but they gradually moved away.
Is there a period of time when you can say that this definitely became a black community?
Well, farther up, farther north, it has been, in fact, I was born up on Tremont Street, and then streets were unpaved, and it was, I would say, more from, a little farther north on that, and it was really the north end then, because the area of Attucks Place and Carver Park were not there, and you felt like you were really pushed back up here to the very end of everything. A lot of people had real old homes and homes that they had built onto, you know, sort of lean to when the family got bigger. And some of them were homes that the people they worked for had given to them, and or let them buy cheap. It was, I think it's always been, blacks have always lived up in this way. In fact, I know that.
And since the founding of the community
mm-hmm.
itself?
Mm-hmm. I see.
But the community has gradually been expanding.
It's gradually going this way mm-hmm. and...
south.
Yeah, going south. Mm-hmm. This way, yeah, south.
Okay.
And with those two new areas up there. And of course over the tracks, I see tracks. And it's odd too that Urbana is, the black settlement in Urbana is right across from us.
Mm-hmm.
It's also north.
Mm-hmm. Is there any reason for that historically, for blacks living on the northern side of the city as opposed to...
I don't know, unless it's because it's close to the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Hop off and come on over.
Good point.
We have had a lot of people stay here that were on railroad crews, you know, come here
mm-hmm.
to work and stay. We've had people stay here from circuses. I remember some people that had stayed from having come here with a circus, and also, especially with the railroad.
To get back to Douglas Center for
mm-hmm.
just a minute, you were saying that some things did not happen that you thought would happen, like you thought there would be greater involvement of adults in the center. Were there any things that happened that you didn't anticipate that were either better than you might have hoped for or worse than you could have imagined?
I think the attendance. the large participation, I think, is well, and then part of the reason for that is there weren't too many other places to go. It was the place to go in the evenings for ball games and so on, and it's just the activity for the area.
Are there any landmarks or, let's say, significant people that you can think of who have made a major difference in the historical development of the so-called the North End as a community? Any buildings that have any that have particular importance or significance, and people that you can think of that stand out as being very important in the history of this community?
Well, when you, the first person I thought of was Richard Edwards, who was the first black person to be elected to the school board. He was also instrumental with my dad and a few others who built the first Douglas Center. Mm-hmm. And he was a person that was very, very well respected in the black community and the white community too. He was listened to, and he was a person that people went to for advice and so on.
What was the basis of his respect and power and authority?
Well, he's still living. He's the kind of person that you could very easily look up to. He was a fair-minded person. Very respectable person. You couldn't find anything. I don't think I've ever heard anything bad about him having been said about him. He belonged to the right organization, the Masonic Lodge, the Elks. He lived in the area in a nice house. And he worked at the post office, that was a good, respectable job. And he was a worker. He didn't just talk it, he did it. A fighter too.
Are there any other people that you can think of that stand out?
Oh, I remember Mrs. Jones. We had a large family. Now they lived across the tracks in the Maple Street area, over in another. It's our black section, but it's an old black section in the city. She was quite a politician and was respected for that. She had a large family, and she was the head of Mrs. Irvin Jones. Of course, her husband was there too, but she was a very well-respected figure. And quite a politician. Another person would be Mrs. Wells, who lived on the campus, who kept students. She was active too, and respected like that. I don't know why I think of women. I don't. Of course, there was my dad. He was very active.
Yeah. What was the basis of his authority or power?
My dad. Let's see. I have to try to see him as other people see him. He and Mr. Edwards were very good friends, and he was a worker too. Once he got started on this idea of a new Douglas Center, he and Mr. Edwards worked hard on it with their wives behind him, pushing He was active with the Masonic Lodge. He was active with what was the Optimist group. He was in a lot of community things and worked in the community. I can look at places that and say my dad had something to do with that, or my dad had helped in doing this or that. I've always said he didn't have any money. He didn't leave us any money, but he certainly left a good name. He's very well respected all over the city, and he worked at the university as a mail carrier. Then he worked in service, serving parties. And he was very well respected there and at the university.
He had his own catering service? Or?
Not exactly. He served parties, so, you know, drinks and so on. He could always remember who drank what.
Important.
Yes, it's important to them. Mm-hmm. And in most everything he got into, he ended up being secretary.
Were there any other major landmarks that he helped to build in addition to the Douglas Center?
Well, the Optimus home, which is now the Francis Nelson Health Center. The Masonic Lodge, when they moved from the place they were in, a rundown place, over to where they are now on First Street. I guess that's about it. The church, Bethel Church, was on the planning committee there. Let's see, who else has been? We had our own one, well, we had one black doctor. There was another one before him, growing. And the other one with Dr. Ellis. We haven't had too many professional people like that, doctors and dentists.
Why is that?
I don't know. They had them in Danville, and we'd go over that, go there to a dentist. But I don't know whether there weren't enough of us here or what. I don't know what the population of Danville is compared to Champaign. But we just haven't had it. We don't have an MD yet.
Actually, Danville has a smaller black population than Champaign.
Yeah.
Champaign has 17,000 people, and we can be giving it the largest black population in this general region of the state.
That's still in here, maybe.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
What about buildings? Which buildings in this community have great historical importance? Douglas Center obviously does.
Mm-hmm.
Could you identify other buildings that would be historical landmarks?
Lyons Field, probably. There's Willard School, probably. No, see, we've torn down a whole lot of things around here. But I don't know too many that are up in this area. But they haven't been kept up either. Churches, of course. Salem Baptist Church.
Which are the oldest churches in the black region?
Bethel not that particular, you know, the church that was before that was still on the corner. Bethel and Salem are the oldest.
Which of the two?
Which of the two is the oldest?
It is the oldest. If it's possible to make that statement.
Bethel. I feel pretty sure, because I think we've gotten into that before. But I do think it's Bethel. You wouldn't think so by looking at it, because it's a new building, comparatively. But I think it was 1865.
When was the current building built?
59.
Was the other building deteriorated?
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Termites even. But
that's an impressive structure. It must have cost quite a bit of money.
It was 70,000 at the time, which sounds cheap now.
But it must have been a lot of money.
Yeah, it was a lot of money then. Mm-hmm. Don Laz was the architect for that, and that was my first experience working with an architect to see how they work. And it was his first church he built. But his idea was to make it so that it would draw people in, you know, that open space in the front, mm-hmm. and then draw people mm-hmm. in. And,
as it would.
Yeah, well, we're not overrun. But it's, and then it seemed in a way that he was really looking ahead, because there are no steps, you know, mm-hmm. and it's easy for the elderly and handicapped and the rest of us to get in and out. So that was really looking ahead on that.
When did you get this, you hear a lot of talk about great waves of migration of blacks moving up to the south, to the north. When did that happen here in Champaign? I mean, is it possible for you to pinpoint a period or several periods of large-scale migration into this community?
No, not in years. I have trouble with that.
Did you ever?
I think in a way it's been kind of gradual, with people coming and finding that they could work at the university, you know, cook and porters. Mm-hmm. And then they send for somebody else who comes. And it's that kind of filtering in.
Is there any rivalry or animosity or hostility, or would you characterize it as more cooperative?
You mean as other people have come in?
Yes, I mean, do the older, more established blacks see newer blacks coming in as a threat or as a help, or neither of those?
I don't think as a threat. Because living in a college community, you get changed, you know, quite a bit anyhow with new students. And mm-hmm. things get slow in the summer, or mm-hmm. used to. They don't change quite as much now as they used to. Mm-hmm. And then they pick up again in the winter and you go back to work. I don't think I have seen that. Because more or less, we're all living up here together and we've got to get along. Mm-hmm. It isn't as if, you know, people were living there. Of course, there are now people living in different sections, but up here, we're here, so we more or less have to get along together.
How are people who don't live here perceived by people who live here? So people who live in these other islands or pockets that you talk about?
That isn't talked about as much as it was for a while. You know, there in the 60s, people were saying, well, you don't live up here, you don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're into that as much as we used to be. You live on the other side of town. got into, had some problems with it when I first came to work up, you know, at Douglas Center, because I lived out in the south part of town. And, you know, that was who you think you are, you know, because you live on the other side of the tracks. But that didn't mean we had any more money than the rest of the people. But I don't think, I don't see so much of that. Maybe it's because we aren't that much into class distinctions or distinctions here at all. I don't see them. Maybe somebody else does. Maybe that's just my attitude.
Your father played with a band.
Yeah, my dad had orchestras as far back as I can remember. And some of them, students from the university, if they could play, you know, and they played dances around smaller towns and here in town. And we fed many a hungry musician. I remember when they had rehearsals, we'd have us cook chili or something and give them something to eat afterwards. It was a big help to a lot of students who came here, and that was when we were living out in the other part of town. And the rehearsals were there in the house. We had a piano. That was also sometime when the carnivals would come, some of the men would be left off, you know, and we've had them come stay at the house. And in fact, one of them left and took some of his clothes with him. But he was Dad was gullible when it came to something like that. He played saxophone. He was self-taught on it. Played saxophone, drums, and xylophone. And then as we got, my brother and I got older, he organized us into an orchestra. He taught my brother to play saxophone. I had had piano lessons. And my brothers, some of my brother's friends played with the group too. We had some pretty good times with playing. And of course, when mine came along, started playing. Went right on with it. And I fed some hungry musicians around here too.
How did the band get organized? And how long did it last? I mean, were they different bands?
They were different. They changed, of course. You know, as long as the students were here, some of them, well, let's see. Theophilus Mann was one of them, who later became a lawyer in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And he played banjo at that time, I think. Mm-hmm. But Dad would hear about other musicians. Or somebody said, well, so I know so-and-so would play something. And they'd come, and he'd get jobs, and they'd play. And, kept them in a little money now and then.
Mm-hmm. Who were the audiences that they played for?
Well, now these were playing. They were playing for dances. People danced then.
Dances, but were they university students or people?
He did play. He did play some jobs at fraternities on the campus. Mm-hmm. Or, and we had dances downtown here. Mm-hmm. We played for white dances in some of the dance halls. Mm-hmm. But fraternities did use bands quite a bit for their spring dances. Mm-hmm. The dances also in the winter, especially spring dances.
How often were they playing? Once a week, once a month?
Well, they rehearsed every week, but then...
I mean, actually playing. Yeah,
playing whenever they could get a gig.
You couldn't give us an average.
No, I couldn't.
What was the biggest event or occasion that they ever played at? Do you recall?
The one I remember was at was a place on Neal Street. I don't remember what the occasion was. It was a white dance. And they had a good sized orchestra, saxophones, trumpet, trombone, trombones. It wasn't a small group, it was a larger group. You did have small groups at times. So. But I don't remember exactly what that occasion was. Mm. But I do remember it being a big dance.
Do you ever make any records?
No.
Play for radio, television?
No.
No. Do you have any recordings of his music?
No, I don't. I wish I did. Yeah. Got a picture or two. Mm-hmm. My husband's father played with Barnum Bailey band. So I guess, and he had an uncle who played the guitar. I guess they were, my kids were destined to play some kind of way.
What kind of changes have you seen with regard to the quality of life for blacks in Champaign? Can you say, think of, say, maybe five things you'd say, these are five greatest changes I've seen in the quality of life, and maybe give us a few reasons for them. And whether you see those as good or bad.
The quality of life. You mean like standards? Values?
Mm-hmm. That. And things like standard of living as well. Whether people materially live better than they did before, worse, and whether that's having an impact on their moral or spiritual life, and so on and so forth.
I'd say they're living better, and living better because there's been some physical changes. In the earlier years, they were walking around through mud, getting from one place to another. And with the new streets, sidewalks and streets and so on, has come more greater desire to fix up their houses and have better houses. With the clearance of the areas, I've seen people become, there were times, for instance, where if somebody had a trashy yard, nobody would say anything about it. You know, you wouldn't think of calling down the city building and saying, I want to do something about these people next door to me. But that's done now. People are concerned about their neighborhoods, how they look. In fact, they're having quite a fit about the Lawhead School area, where a man has put all those no-good cars in the yard, and they're wanting to get him out. And I'd say that people are much more concerned about the houses they live in, the places they live, the neighborhoods, than they used to be.
Is that good? Is that
happening? Yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you think of other things? Are there four other things?
Well, I don't know what kind of jobs they've gone to, but people have gotten into better jobs where the kind of work done was in somebody's kitchen. You know, the wife and the husband both worked in service. Those people have gotten into different kinds of jobs. Maybe some are still there, but I don't know very many people now who do day work like they used to. I think one bad thing that has happened is we have a whole group of people, men and women, who aren't old enough for Social Security that are just in the middle type, with no good incomes or bad health, or their health isn't good, and the only income they have, some of them, if they have any at all, is a disability, and they have trouble finding places to live. That, to me, that group is that age group is a forgotten group. And I don't know. They're just a forgotten bunch of people. And that's both men and women. I don't know. I guess there are some men. Maybe some of those people have gone to work in construction. I don't know. That's one of the bad things I've seen. There's nothing. We don't have any factories here, or very few. We've got Humco and Kraft. Those two places have supplied some good jobs. That's about it.
Well, I think that this concludes our interview.
Yeah, I've run out.
If there's something that I have overlooked for some reason, should I feel free to contact you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on behalf of Douglas Library and the University of Illinois and myself, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time and interest to allow us to interview.
It's fun to remember.
Mm-hmm. And it's very valuable for the community. We hope we'll have this written up in a form that will be useful to the entire community sometime in the very near future. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.